Okay, let's have it. Yes.
Okay, so we must obey authority just by virtue of their office. What if they misuse their office and are commanding us to do something that is unreasonable and against the
common good? Yeah, so let's distinguish cases. There can be cases where the unreasonableness approaches indifference, where what you mean by unreasonable is something like, well, I wouldn't have done it that way. That's the most mild case. There can be a case where you say, I disagree with you, but maybe it's one of those hard calls where reasonable people can actually disagree among each other, right? And through those, that swath of cases, it seems to me, we're dealing with the cases that authority was built to address, and we are morally bound to obey. There can exist cases where what the authority is doing is against the common good in a way that is not open to disagreement among reasonable people. And that would be the situation where the logic that binds you to obey them would untie, right? It's no longer the case that the common good itself is binding you to what they say. Those cases are pretty extreme. And that is, if we're honest with ourselves, we hardly meet them. But they happen, right? The authority can come in and say, kill these Jews, right? Or the authority can come in and say, yeah, just do this wicked action. Or, you know, if somebody from the United States government told you to, you know, blow up the White House or something, you know, there are extreme cases where it would be clear, right? But I think when we have to be cautious dealing with those cases, because when there's a hard call situation and you think about it carefully, you tend to get invested in your answer. And emotions run high, and we tend to think of things as maybe even a bigger deal than they are. So it's very easy to push what is in reality a hard call case into the case of, no, there cannot be disagreement among reasonable people. No moral person could say what this authority is saying. Okay, it's easy to go there, so we just have to treat it with caution. But it absolutely does happen that authorities will sometimes say something that no reasonable person could admit was for the company, you know, was anything but detrimental to the common good. And in that case, you would be bound to disobey. Yep, absolutely. Yes, Mr. Wrench.
Do you feel comfortable addressing some of the decisions made by the college ever since I was a student in which...
You mean from year one? Yeah. Oh, I'm now responsible for the whole history of the college. Okay, let's just roll with that, yeah.
You know, students made transgressions of the college rules. And the sentiment, at least, was the college acted in a way to prevent this behavior in the future, and in doing so, punish a given student in excess of what their actions actually deserved. Do you feel comfortable commenting on those types of conversations that have happened over the years?
That way of putting the question would kind of fall a little bit outside of my topic, just because if an authority comes down really hard on Billy Bob, I might look and say, oh, goodness, that was harsh. But the authority is not telling me to do anything or telling me not to do anything, so there's not a question of my obedience or disobedience. There's no moral obligation for me relating to... That kind of happened to him, and I think it was a bad thing that happened to him. I guess we could make that a topic, but you see how it kind of falls outside the question I was asking.
It's just a way that, like, I have a possible answer that I want to check to see if you might agree with. Would that be an instance of the authority sort of signifying how much of its authority it's putting in between you and the decision you're making? Kind of like, am I just putting in a corner, or am I putting the whole thing in? maybe a way of communicating that would be to really make an example of a couple of offenders to show that, yes, I really mean this. Pay more attention. I guess, so in that case, it's unfortunate and less than ideal that it happened for the guy who's being made an example of, but it's an instance of the authority just showing how much it
means. John Paul, thank you for that. That's very clarifying. I think we all know that authorities work that way, right? That when you get your first offender against whatever, every authority whose job it is to protect the common good will have to think to themselves, if I go light on this guy, I'm basically encouraging the next guy. If I want them to understand that I really mean it, I have to come down really hard. Now, the version that one might have in mind would be some kind of weird inequity where five guys do it and two of them get it hard. And then you'd say, okay, that would be a totally different topic. But if it's a question where, yes, the authority has come down really, really hard, but consistently and equitably, then I think your analysis is exactly right. That's one of the ways that we let people know, as parents, right? Just in a sort of common sense way. You know, the kid steals the cookie, and you think it's kind of cute. Because you're like, you know, what do you have behind your back? And like, nothing. And then they turn around to run away, you know, still holding it behind their back, and you're really tempted to just giggle out loud. But you kind of know this is time for the stern face, because otherwise they won't understand that we really mean it about stealing, right? And so on up to very important situations like, you know, drug abuse and so on, where you know, you'd say, wow, that really is a huge deal. And the authorities will definitely have to think about the messaging question. Yeah, thank you. That's very helpful. Caleb.
Is there ever a situation in which you would reject an authority's, like authority, totally not just in a particular case? And I guess it's like, because what Kay was bringing up is that there would be particular laws you might disagree with, but you would still be morally bound to follow the other ones, right? But at what point would you be just bound, more, at least permitted or perhaps morally bound to completely reject the authority altogether?
Right. So that can happen, and there's a couple of layers to that, right? Layer number one is you would have to become convinced that the authority not only has made bad decisions or even made immoral decisions, but that the authority is an enemy of the good, of the common good of the community, right? You would have to have identified him not as occasionally bad, but as, by his disposition, the enemy, the traitor, right? That would be layer number one. But that identification doesn't automatically make it moral to totally abandon him, because as is so rightly pointed out in the Declaration of Independence, overthrowing an authority and establishing a new one is a really traumatic, messy process that usually involves lots of harm. And so long as living under this enemy, under this tyrant, is tolerable, it very likely will be more reasonable to let it ride and hope by other means to eventually get someone else into authority than to, say, go to war, right? But it may get to the point where not only have you confidently identified him as the enemy, you also say, and it's intolerable. Now, that's a squishy term, right? But you have to somehow have reached that decision that it's not just that he's the enemy. It's that the consequences of his being the enemy are impossible to live with, intolerable. And so now we actually have to expel him. And that can happen. And that, in theory, should be the justification behind every coup, right? Or, for example, to come closer to home. You can have parents who aren't the best parents. You know, you as you get older, you realize they're not the brightest. They make poor decisions. They've got tempers. They blow up sometimes and do things they shouldn't have done. But and so you start to realize at some point, maybe this is even verging into abusive. If you start to say this is even getting abusive, you would say, oh gee, I should think about whether I need to cut myself off from these people. But you still have to think about it, right? Is it on the whole more tolerable to endure these people in your lives than to sever the relationship with the family entirely? Because that is an enormous, messy step with lots of consequences, and most of them bad. So it can happen, but it's not that common, right? We're interested in those extreme cases for analysis purposes, but they're not actually the ones that help us in day-to-day, you know, just in normal everyday life. Even though emotions run high, and you know, dad says something, and you're like, "You're absolutely the worst, and I'm never speaking to you again." Like, and then you realize a little later, okay, you know. So day to day, unlikely, but yes, absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, I wanted to ask a question whether the definition of common good that you gave and the account really, if that's really been a necessary step in the argument. And here's my question about it: wouldn't it be true that every community needs some authority, even if the community is created by what would in fact be private goods that are shared rather than common goods as you define them? And so you need an authority to divide the cake among the children. If you have a family that's inherited property, you need authority to allocate how it's going to be divided. You probably don't really have to have an authority for two people to be friends, or two people to share wisdom, or some number even to share wisdom, that the authority is necessary simply because there's a community. And it's probably more important when the community is better, or more necessary when the community has private goods that will be diminished as they're shared, than with common goods that won't be diminished as they're shared. So that was my objection, and I wanted to hear your response.
Yeah, so... To answer it, we have to do something that I think is kind of abstract and unreal. It's actually difficult to think about groups of people who don't really have a common good, where what there really is only a collaboration for the sake of each of our private goods. I think it can happen, but I think most instances we would look at, somehow the group has become richer than that. Something else is entered in. But let's pursue that for the sake of analysis. I think that what the reason that the argument would falter is because since the authority is meaningful to me as securing my private good, then if I judge that my private good is actually augmented by going against the authority, then I just kind of have two competing private goods, and I decide which one is greater. I need the common good step to say that the good is greater, to say that pitting my private good against it is not going to be a rational thing to do. But if what's at stake is my private good, then pitting another private good against it might be rational. And it's true that not every group that shares a common good has an authority. And it's definitely true that authority, the way that a common good creates the need for an authority really comes into play the more people there are involved, right? So, for example, in a family, the headship of the husband almost makes no sense as long as there's just a couple, you know, young people in love. You go out to dinner, and what is she going to ask his permission about what to order? You know, it's not instinctive to most people. And yet, as the number of children grows, it does sort of naturally fall into a pattern where somebody takes at least the role of accepting the blame for everything that goes wrong. So in a way, it is the number of the people. I think you're absolutely right. Is sort of most immediately the source of the need for somebody to coordinate common action. But I guess my case was, it's only going to always, it's only going to consistently result in a moral obligation for you if that group, that community, is a community grounded in a, that was created by a common good. Otherwise, it won't be predictably irrational to disobey the authority. It might just be more, very often more convenient. Yeah?
I have an objection as well.
Okay. By the way, that's my father in the corner who's going after me on the issue of authority. So I I am in hot water right now. Yes.
I actually agree with you, but I won't object to any of it because that's how I roll. So, having heard your response to Kate and to Caleb, what would you say to the objection that your solution is actually just your third initial response? What you're really saying is it's not the authority, it's the truth about the common good that binds you. And that's why when it's clear that they're opposed to the common good, you're no longer bound. I mean, maybe it's not an objection to the account, but to the dichotomy between the three views and your view.
Yeah, so here is a way of stating what an authority is able to do. Here's a way of describing his fundamental power. The authority can create a concrete relationship between a given course of action and the common good, where previously there may have been only an indeterminate relationship. And so, for example, in indifferent matters, or in the case of hard calls, where perhaps there is objectively out there in some way a determinate relationship, but there's no determinate relationship that we can see. The authority has the power to make the relationship of a course of action to the common good determinate. And so it is true that ultimately what drives my moral obligation is not the authority, but the common good. But it's the common good that the authority is able to, in a sense, wield to create the obligation.
So would it be fair then to say there's still a difference, is what you're saying? And one difference, one example of the difference would be this, that on the third response as initially presented, there's no more reason why that guy would have the right to judge this is what's for the common good than me. But you're saying, in fact, that guy actually does have the right to do it. That's why the benefit of the doubt goes to him. When it's not, when we can't see our way clearly. Or that's why he gets to tell him which side of the road to drive on, and I don't, or something like that.
I suppose someone might say, if I sort of signed the contract, maybe part of the contract was who gets to decide. So I've bound myself to letting him decide.
Although I wasn't presenting it as the contract view, but that's the view about the truth about the good.
Oh, sorry. Yes, yes. You're absolutely right. Yep, that's right. That view does inevitably, if held strictly, devolve into I do the authority when he says what I agree with, and I don't do what the authority says if he says what I don't agree with, which amounts to he can't really tell me what to do. He might remind me of things I know. Thanks, Mr. Authority Figure. You're right, I did know that. But that's not authority.
Yeah. What do you mind saying? Almost just an empirical fact that what the government says about which side of the road you drive on has a different relationship to the common good than what I say about that question.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Ainsley.
I guess I'm just not really understanding your point, because the conclusion I've kind of come to in my head is that when we follow somebody because they're the symbol of a common good, it opens the avenue for them to essentially turn us into mindless sheep in a way, where we would just follow them because they proclaim to be the symbol of common good. And how would you, I guess I haven't had my question answered, but how would you guide us through that kind of decision-making process without turning to reason three that you gave, that we should follow through? Because I feel like it's a very easy way for someone to cleverly say that this is for the common good, and based on your reasoning, we would follow it because they could give a convincing argument, even though it would not be true.
No, the reason wouldn't be because they could give a convincing argument, right? the reason would be because they inhabit the office, right? Well, this guy actually is the mayor, so I guess we have to do it, right? That would be the reason. That is, if my account led to an abuse, the abuse would not be based on the mayor's having given the best argument or the cleverest argument. That would take in the people who do something because they think it's right. All right, if you obey the authority only when you think he's right, and then he gives a really clever argument that takes you in, then you're going to follow him. I think the abuse to which the authority on my account is in fact open is in a way more dangerous than what you're talking about, because it doesn't depend on his ability to be clever. He just has to inhabit the office. But the common, when you talk about making people mindless sheep, you're talking about taking away their good. And that's a false understanding of the common good, right? To take away your flourishing is not to give you the common good. It's to take it away from you, right? If I reduced you to a mindless sheep in this community, I would be depriving you of the very good this community exists to foster, for example, right? And I would argue the same for, say, the good of our country, right? Our country exists for things like our flourishing, our happiness, our fullness as human beings. And if our leaders exercise their office in order to take away the fullness of your human life, then they're actually acting against the goods that their office exists to deliver. And then we're into the abuse situations that other people have asked about, and you have to go through that discernment process. Once you discover that your authority is reducing people to mindless sheep, you're into the analysis. Uh-oh, we now have an enemy of the common good. Is this intolerable? If so, we overthrow him. If not, we deal for a while. Right? But the authority by his nature should be contributing to your flourishing, right? So, as the father of my family, I support, protect, bolster the good of my family. But that good includes things like everyone growing in wisdom and happiness, right? So for example, my wife and I have common goods, and there's kind of weird ones because it's my kids, right? You wouldn't think of people as common goods, but it's true. One of the things that my wife and I share is kids. That's part of being spouses, is that you hear these kids and like they're her kids, but it's kind of weird. They're also my kids. And marriage works that way. And now they are common goods for us. And so protecting and bolstering the common good that my wife and I share should be good for them. If I start turning my children into mindless sheep, I'm a bad parent. I'm actually exercising my office badly. Now we're into the abuse situation, and we have to follow those analyses. So the fundamental thing to see, and maybe to work on over time, is to see that the common good really is the better thing for you, not the better thing for someone else. We're used to speaking of the common good as though it's the good, I don't know, of the government or something. Right? Well, we're going to have to give this up. You know, I have to give up my money for the good of the government so it can do its thing. But we have to be careful not to confuse. If one, the moment things start being directed to the good of the government is just a group of people, right? If once we start funneling things towards their private good, they are no longer functioning as the protectors of the common good, right? And so that was sort of the fundamental fallacy of communism, is to take the common good and then kind of relocate it to being the good of the organization that controls the country, and then funnel everything toward it, which is really wicked. So that's a really hard step to see, but the common good, rightly conceived, is not only better for other people, but better for you. I know, yeah, sorry. But we can work on that. Yes. But you've looked several times like you had a question. Have you been trying to get in?
No.
Okay.
I'm sorry to bring me back to that one question, but I just don't see how that's not an extreme version of your something until it becomes not.
So reason three, just to rehearse, was authority tells me, thou shalt do X. It turns out that doing X is in fact the right thing to do, and I realize, yep, doing X is in fact, objectively speaking, the best thing to do. So I do it. I do it because it's the right thing to do. But I don't do it because the authority told me, I just do it because it's the right thing to do. That was number three. My solution, my proposal would involve cases where there may not be a single right thing to do. There's nothing for me to see. But I'm still going to obey the authority and be under a moral obligation. Mr. Rich.
In light of that, what do you make of sort of much of modern parenting advice, which encourages parents to explain their line of reasoning to their children? I mean, is that fundamentally a poor tactic? Because it creates this impression that we only obey because of reason number three?
You know, I used to be in doubt about that, and my seventh child convinced me. That's not a good tactic. Every time he asks me why, it's so that he can argue. And he's really good at arguing. He's so smart. He always has another reason, like another solution to, you know, what I'm saying. I just by experience, I have concluded that it's not always best to give your reasons. Sometimes you need to withhold reasons to help kids learn to obey because I'm your father. That said, one of the goods that I'm supposed to foster in my children is the ability to think well about how to live. And so as they age, it becomes more and more incumbent on me. So I would never, for example, tell my 16-year-old to do something and then refuse to answer his question why. He's at a point where that refusal might be more detrimental to the good I'm trying to protect. Whereas with my 5-year-old, it seems like it goes the other way. To foster the virtue that he needs, sometimes he needs to learn to obey without my having explained. I would say that it's not one answer for everybody. It depends on what is most conducive to the good of the family, which includes the good of this kid, since he is in a weird way one of the common goods of the family.
Follow-up question is, at the root of your argument, are you saying that ultimately authority has the right to act in those gray areas when the right course of action is not known even to reasonable people? Is that just it, or is it more than that?
Well,
is that an oversimplification?
Yeah, that is a little bit overly simple. The need for the authority includes a number of things. It includes hard cases, hard calls where it's just a misty zone. It includes indifferent things where it's perfectly clear it's just indifferent. There's no principle by which to make the decision. Somebody has to make one, like right side of the road, left side of the road, whatever. It includes areas where it's not indifferent, but there are many reasonable things to do. We just need to do one of them. And everyone needs to do the one thing. It also includes areas where all reasonable people would agree on this, but this guy's not reasonable. And he needs to do it too. That's also something that creates the need for authority, right? That the reality that not everybody in the situation is reasonable. We've got bad guys. So all of those would be things that funnel into the general need that a common good has for an authority. Yes.
Would there ever be a circumstance where the authority would command something unreasonable, but it wasn't that big a deal, so you should follow it anyway?
All the time. Yeah, all the time. Yep. That's. Yeah.
Like, what if it was?
That is, if they're commanding you to do something unreasonable, but it's not that big a deal, you're kind of saying, but it doesn't really hurt, or the evil is negligible. then it seems like the evil of trampling the office of the authority is greater than the evil of doing that thing. So the logic would say you obey.
So you are saying there would be certain things like that.
Yeah, and the reality is you can't have an authority that says the reasonable thing all the time. That's not going to happen in real life. So if you made it a kind of condition of authority that you have to be right 100% of the time, reasonable 100% of the time, you would just sort of blow things up, right? We know that. Well, I certainly know that from my experience as a parent, where you know how many times have I had to say to myself, "Okay, that was dumb. That was not the way to handle that. I said the wrong thing." I spent a few years as academic dean, and again had to say to myself sometimes, "Guess I blew that one. That was not the thing to say." Maybe even other people told me that was not the thing to say, right? It's just the normal experience of trying to exercise authority in real life as a human being. I think one of the conditions that allows us to have the authority that is called for by the common good is giving it that latitude to even be wrong sometimes. As long as it's not, you know, right? It's, as you said, not a big deal, but... Right. There are various things. Yeah, there's an interesting case that goes to eventually, though. If it's not a big deal, but it's really, really dumb, it can actually start to hurt the common good in a kind of weird way. Run this scenario in your head. The legislature passes, bicameral United legislation signed by the president that henceforward, if you leave your domicile, you have to keep your right index finger on top of your head at all times. And you can only take it off when you re-enter your domicile. That's going to make it hard to drive. Now we all have to write left-handed, which I guess we can do. Businesses are going to be hard to run. It's just so, so dumb. And it's so dumb that everybody instantly says, everybody says, that's dumb. And there's going to be a series of effects right away. One is going to be a sudden flagging of confidence in the guys inhabiting the office, right? You're going to be a lot less zealous about the next thing they say, just inevitably, kind of humanly speaking, psychologically. You're going to be like, they're the guys with the index finger law. You're right, yeah, I remember them. But... the next thing that's going to happen is because it's so dumb, most people will disobey it, right? Beyond a certain point of dumbness, people won't do it. And when lots of people disobey the law, then what happens is there is suddenly created a culture of disregard for law, right? Suddenly the respect for law itself sags, right? There's a further consequence. Those stalwart few who spend their days like this with their right index finger on their heads, they are the people who take the law absolutely most seriously. And they bear all the evils of the law. And all the people who habitually disregard the law, they're the people who aren't suffering. There's a tremendous inequity there that the bad guys are getting the rewards and the good guys are getting punished. So... and that itself leads to, again, a kind of further sagging of the status of the office, of the authority itself. So law, even when it's not commanding something very wicked, if it commands something very stupid, if it's just a silly law, it can actually be harmful to the common good. And I'm not sure where that analysis goes. I'm still thinking about that. But that would be a paradigm, perhaps, for thinking about prohibition. Where they say, you can't drink alcohol. Now, is abstaining from alcohol a terrible thing to do? No. Lots of people, in fact, lots of Americans abstain from alcohol entirely. It's whatever. It instantly created a whole subculture of people disobeying the law. Father Schumacher, our local parish priest, told me a story about it. He heard from a parishioner at a previous church he was at, there's this And this parishioner was talking about her mother, who was an adult during the Prohibition. And her mother, like so many, came from a Eastern European background in which liquor was just kind of a cultural thing. And so when the Prohibition came out, most of them just started making homebrew liquor. And she just did it in her kitchen, you're right, whatever. And the police raided her kitchen and took her stuff, you know, and, you know, whatever. And then she went back to doing it, and, you know, and they raid her again and take her stuff, you know, and she said she was out on the street walking with her brother one time, and they passed a policeman. He said, "Hey, how's your mother doing?" And she's fine. Why are you asking how my mother's doing? And they said, "Oh, we were just worried about her. Her liquor wasn't really so good this time." In a situation like that, respect for law has gone blank. You know. So even laws that aren't commanding the inherently wicked can actually be contrary to the common good. And I honestly don't know where to take that analysis and what to make of that situation. Yeah. Yeah, again, I think you have to we have to rerun the analyses we've done because we have to differentiate it into situations. There are all the time. If you ever are in a situation of authority, you become vividly aware that all the time there are coming at you decisions where you'll know in 5 years whether this is the right thing to do. 5 years later, you're going to look back and say, either, yep, that was it, or, oh man, we blew that one. But you can't know yet whether this is right. But we have to do some one thing together, and the authority will say what to do. And it may be that there is some particularly brilliant individual who somehow can discern far enough in advance that he legitimately can see that this is not the right thing to do. But it is, in fact, a hard call. And that kind of situation is one of the things authorities are instituted to handle. So if we say that it's not a law, if it turns out to have been unreasonable, in that case, we're going to have to say, well, what do you mean by reasonable? It was the kind of thing a reasonable person could have said at the time in the situation. We also have to come back to the question that was asked here up front, that is, by unreasonable, do you mean unreasonable and not a big deal? Because if we don't allow authorities the possibility of being wrong in little ways here and there, even when we can see it, you're basically never going to allow an authority in your life, because they're all going to be wrong sometimes. And that's something I try to impress with my kids as young as possible. you will eventually realize that I'm wrong sometimes. When you do, don't panic. So it seems to me that we have to say, if the authority says to do something that reasonable people would not say, you would never get agreement among reasonable people that this is for the common good, then we might be then that's not a law. It's contrary to reason, in an important way. But in those other cases, I think that we just have to open a little flexibility in our definition. Sir.
In what areas were you thinking that we should allow flexibility? We had mentioned the idea of losing the common good. The actions you were mentioning earlier, Jesus, if you lose some common good. Given that the role of government is to provide and protect and care for the common welfare, the common good of people, are those the areas in which you see civic disobedience being what those parents actually put their thing?
That was a little too vague for me to follow. Can you?
Okay, I'll try to help a bit. Given the role, given that government needs to provide for the common welfare, common good, and that sometimes the authorities can implement such things that go directly against the common good, are those cases where we have this standard of unreasonableness? Is that something that A meets that standard of unreasonableness? Not so that you have to overthrow the government, but just merely not engage in obeying that specific rule.
Yeah, let me give some examples. While this may not always be the best tactic, I think that our abortion laws are the kind of thing that are so detrimentally, so extremely against the common good that they could justify people disobeying the law in relation to those, right? So sit-ins that, where people go lay down in front of a clinic and then the police come and drag them away. I don't think those people are being wicked when they do that. We could debate the effectiveness of the tactic or something, right? The civil disobedience that was engaged in relation to laws of racial inequity, way back, right? Excluding black people from various goods of our country. I think that civil disobedience was justified, right? Because it's so against the good of this country to act that way, right? That's the kind of thing I have in mind. And those are, as you can see, are big cases where, we're talking about killing millions of people, for example. That's a really, really big one. It's not a no big deal. It's not even close to no big deal, right? I don't pretend to be a prophet and be able to name all such cases and discriminate them perfectly from one another, right? Obviously, big deal is a sliding scale. And somewhere you cross the line, and I don't pretend to be able to draw that line perfectly. But those would be a couple examples where I would be confident that there could easily be situations where obedience to those laws would simply not be called for. Okay, I realize that one does not get to the end of the questions, but happily, we live together. And there is another day. So I think we're going to wrap this up right now. And I hope this conversation continues. And by all means, hit me up around campus if you'd like to pursue it. God bless.